Hello there. Today is Thursday, May 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump is now in Brussels for a NATO summit where terrorism will dominate. The latest on the Manchester investigation.
We are carrying out extensive searches of premises across Manchester.
Analysis of a new report on the Republican health care bill. And also ahead, social media, entertainment, and a movie review. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump Wednesday said he is more determined than ever to pursue peace in our world following his 30-minute meeting at the Vatican with Pope Francis. As VOA's Jeff Custer reports, Trump on Twitter called the meeting an honor of a lifetime.
The two men, meeting for the first time Wednesday, shook hands. The Pope appeared somber. The president grinned. After the president's private meeting with the Pope in the Apostolic Palace, there was a brief expanded audience for other members of the U.S. delegation. That encounter included an exchange of gifts. The president presented the pontiff with books from Martin Luther King. The Pope gave Trump what he said was a medal by a Roman artist. He said it was an olive, which is a symbol of peace. The Pope also gave the president three books on the topics of family, the joy of the gospel, and care of our common home, the environment. Later, Trump reflected on the meeting.
He is something. He is really good. We had a fantastic meeting and we had a fantastic tour. It was really beautiful. We're liking Italy very much. The Prime Minister, everybody. But we're liking Italy very, very much, yeah. And it was an honor to be with the Pope.
After separate meetings with Italian officials, Trump left on Air Force One, bound for Belgium. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
Well, following his visit with Pope Francis at the Vatican, President Trump arrived in Brussels ahead of meetings Thursday with NATO leaders. He called terrorism the number one problem currently facing the world. And speaking to reporters Wednesday en route to Belgium, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the Manchester attack will only serve to strengthen ties between the U.S. and the Atlantic Alliance.
I think that horrible attack in Manchester just reminded all of us why we have to do this. And the president said that in remarks to embassy staff today. He said, you know, it just reminds us why we have to win this fight, and we have to do it. We can't leave it for someone else to do.
NATO leaders arrived in Brussels amid tight security for Thursday's summit. It's the first encounter many of the leaders will have with U.S. President Donald Trump, who during the campaign called the alliance obsolete for not effectively countering terrorism. Recent terror attacks in Europe mean the U.S. leader may get the support he needs to strengthen the alliance's anti-terrorist efforts. Meanwhile, thousands of demonstrators marched in central Brussels Wednesday, protesting against both NATO and Trump. Well, British police say the suicide bomber who attacked a concert in Manchester did not act alone. Manchester Chief Constable Ian Hopkins said during a news conference Wednesday that a terror network was involved.
People across Greater Manchester will have seen a significant increase in the number of armed officers on mobile patrol and at static points across the city. We have been supported by forces from across the northwest and beyond.
The bomber has been identified as 22-year-old Salman Abedi. International Edition's Sarah Williams asks Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute in London, whether he agrees with the assessment that this was not a lone wolf incident.
I think it would be very surprising if this individual was discovered, Salman Abedi was discovered to have acted alone. I think if we look at the device that he detonated and the sort of level of sophistication and training that would have gone into the preparation of it, that suggests that he's had contact with someone else somewhere along the way. In addition, if the stories that he's just returned to the United Kingdom from abroad a few days ago are true, it would confirm that because it would suggest it would be unclear that he would have had enough time to do this all by himself.
Now, apparently, Salman Abedi was known by British intelligence services. He had a background in his parents were from Libya. There have been reports, I don't know if this has been confirmed, that he spent some time in Syria. Is it possible that there was some oversight, or was this really understandable that authorities, you know, hadn't paid perhaps a bit more attention to him?
I mean, I think the problem is that, you know, there are lots of people that fit. So far, we don't know for certain that he's into Syria, though it wouldn't be surprising. The fact of him travelling to Libya, he is ultimately of Libyan heritage and his parents live there, so it's not abnormal for him to travel there. I think the question is, when you're looking at security agencies and the number of people that they're looking at, they have a range of people. They have incomplete information on all of them. And the question is, they have to prioritize within that which ones to focus more attention on at any given moment in time. And, you know, getting that prioritization right is very difficult with an incomplete information picture. So I think the difficulty comes into understanding why the choices were made not to focus on him versus focusing on others. And that is something that's very difficult for an outsider to know, because we don't get to see the entire intelligence picture.
And what about connections to Islamic State? You know, there's been discussion in the past over whether attacks were inspired or actually directed by Islamic State. What could this look like?
I mean, at this point, we don't really know. I mean, certainly if we are looking at an instance where we have an individual who received a bomb, he went and then detonated at the target, then you're looking at a cell which has at least two people involved in it. Now, whether this is Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or someone else, at this point, it's unclear. All we do know is that Islamic State did release a message about this operation in which they appeared to claim it, but their claims in the past have been somewhat scattered. And in some cases, they claim things that is not clear with them. But in other cases, they haven't claimed things that were quite clearly them. So I don't know that we necessarily can interpret a lot from that.
Well, meanwhile, Britain has raised its terrorism alert level to critical. And I believe there are soldiers will be, in some capacity, replacing police officers. I mean, in the UK, is it noticeable today that security has been tightened?
So, I mean, I work on Whitehall, which is right opposite where all the government departments are, where Downing Street is, and just down the road from Parliament. And certainly it was noticeable that security around Parliament was tighter. There were police and security and a heavier presence. And there was soldiers going around in uniform, you know, with guns, which is something that we don't usually see in London, quite frankly. But I think the key point to think about raising the threat level to critical is the reflection of the fact that authorities are uncertain that they have total sight of the cell. It's also worth pointing out that over the past few years, when it has been rated critical, it has been in the wake of successful incidents. And it's basically a measure for the authorities to give the police greater latitude and give the army greater latitude to be able to operate in the homeland, something that is usually not really permitted. And that theoretically helps sort of put more resources towards dealing with the problem, as well also as doing a sort of public assurance job.
That's Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute of London. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. U.S. and Russia boost communication to head off Syria incidents. U.S. FBI Director's search back to drawing board for the Trump team. Immigrants reach out after the Manchester attack. And a new World Health Organization chief is stressing health as a human right. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. An estimated 23 million Americans could lose health insurance over a 10-year period under the Republican health care bill aimed at repealing the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. That's according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. The CBO released its analysis of the House-passed bill Wednesday, giving the public an estimate of the impact the measure would have on health coverage, premiums, and the nation's budget. Replacing the Affordable Care Act was a priority of Donald Trump during his presidential campaign and of Republican lawmakers. Joining me now for more on the report is healthcare law expert Rob Fuller, a partner with the Los Angeles-based healthcare firm Nelson Hardiman. Thanks for being with us. So what do we know about this report?
My own impression of the report is that the CBO was as generous toward the Republicans as they could be. I score slightly higher on the insured loss. I think instead of 23 million people losing their insurance, I think it'll be closer to 30. I think they picked some factors very much in favor of the Republicans that may or may not come true. But I think that the headline of the number of people losing insurance obscures what I think is actually a larger issue, which I hope gets some discussion, which is the quality of insurance that people will have is going to be diminished for many tens of millions of more people than the 23 million who might lose insurance. The erosion of the minimum benefit requirements is going to turn a lot of insurance policies into what we call the low-cost, low-coverage, low-benefits policy, where you'll have essentially the old catastrophic major medical kind of coverage that will, you know, be available if you get in a bad car accident, but otherwise won't cover much in the way of regular, ordinary wellness health care. So people should understand that. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with that design system. It's basically what we have for car insurance. If you think about it, car insurance covers accidents, but your oil changes and your regular maintenance is something you pay for. And that's essentially the Republican design. When you strip the rhetoric away, you extend the availability of HSAs, health savings accounts, and then you provide some sort of catastrophic medical insurance coverage. And you would have a system that looks a lot like car insurance, and it might do very well for a large portion of Americans.
But of course, we're human beings. We're not cars.
No, we're not cars. We're not that reliable. And we actually break down a lot more than cars these days. It's not quite a good analogy. Just start grasping at why this big structural change is there. You know, that's the direction that the Republican bill would move in. You've got a very hard political issue, though, which is putting aside the minimum benefits and the content of insurance policies. The headline number doesn't mean 23 million people who have insurance now and, you know, have some opportunity at least to access the healthcare system are going to lose that opportunity. And that's a very difficult backward step, if you will, to take for the population, which is a large 8% roughly of the American population.
What does this do for people who have employer-based health care?
So the minimum benefits, if the state gets a waiver from it that allows insurance companies to offer less than the current minimum benefits, that will allow employers to offer policies that have less coverage than they do today. What we're waiting to happen is, and this hasn't been addressed yet, is the idea of a regional insurance plan. You will allow insurance companies to have regional, maybe even nationwide insurance plans. If they're regional and you force every employer to be able to take any plan that's approved within the region, despite what the local state law may say, you could have a situation where maybe California keeps the minimum benefit regulations, but Arizona reduces them substantially. But the federal law says that a California employer meets all the state law if it gets the Arizona reduced benefits policy. So I think you're going to have an opportunity for employers to spend a lot less on health care insurance if you regionalize or go national on some of the benefit designs, and that's something that's being talked about. So I do think it does impact everybody. Also, there will be upward pressure on premiums no matter what, because I ran a hospital for 10 years, and I can tell you that when I ran that hospital, I had a certain number of people showed up that I had to give health care to, and they were absolutely had no ability to pay. They weren't eligible for Medi-Cal as it was out here in California, and I had to just give them the care as I was required to do under EMTALA, the federal law, and I had to then pay a doctor to help give that care because the doctor wouldn't do it, you know, for free. So if you knock all these people off of the insurance rolls, hospitals are going to have to get more into that game again and require private insurers to pick up the slack for what the no-pay patients who will still get sick, they'll still seek care, and they'll still come to hospitals because they know that under EMTALA, hospitals have to provide that care. So you're going to have the ER become more of the focus of health care again, and then you're going to have this silent tax on the employer-based plans.
Okay, so it goes to the Senate. It'll likely completely change its form. Just to wrap this whole thing up, what's your summary of what we're seeing now with this whole health care debate? Do you think that Obamacare is being demonized more than it should be? Obviously, it has problems. Do you think it's, in your professional opinion, should it be fixed? Should it be replaced? Should we go back to what we had, which was, you know, go it alone before we had Obamacare? What's your view?
In the book that I wrote with my partner, Harry Nelson, my law partner, we were very succinct that putting the rhetoric aside, you did have a choice between two fundamentally different approaches. One, Obamacare being insurance, really health insurance. And two, the federal government saying, we don't want to be in the insurance business or set the insurance rules. Let the states do it, and we'll give people tax credits if they can't afford what they have to do. There's a belief in the free market on the Republican side, and there's a distrust of the free market and the insurance companies, especially on the Democratic side. And that, so far, hasn't played out. We simply know there is a problem that we spend twice as much for health care per person as any other developed country, and we have not yet come to the political compromise or the solution that's going to allow that to happen. My personal view is that we should stay in the insurance business, and the federal government should have some major say of setting the rules, but perhaps there should be some higher state involvement and maybe some better controls on insurance companies that would let the markets work better. It's not solved by either repealing Obamacare or by the tax credits that are put into place. The problem is we're in a transition, and the ultimate solution has not yet come up yet.
All right. Rob Fuller, partner with Los Angeles-based healthcare firm Nelson Hardiman. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues now with news from the entertainment world with Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Nicole, thanks for being with us. Lots of celebrities talking about the horrific bombing in Britain.
So Celine Dion, like many other celebrities, was really affected by the bombing that happened at the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester. So on Tuesday night, she stopped in the middle of her show and took a moment to talk to her audience about how she was feeling about the victims and how heartbroken she was for them and their families. She asked her audience to send thoughts and prayers to the victims and their families, and she was really choked up as she was addressing everybody in the room. At one point, she actually asked the entire room, the audience, her backup vocalist, and her band to stand. She asked for the lights in the room to go up, and she asked everybody to hold hands, and the whole room took a moment of silence. She also talked about Ariana Grande and how sad she was that that had happened to her. So it just shows that everybody's really shaken by what happened.
For sure, and you know, particularly a celebrity that was apparently targeted specifically this event. Mm-hmm. So just horrific indeed. And then you've got some news of Madonna's getting a lot of pushback for something she posted.
So the saying is it takes a village to raise a child, and I guess Madonna learned that when she posted a photo of one of her daughters on Instagram this week. The photo is an adorable photo of her 4-year-old twins, but in the picture is a little bit of an inappropriate decoration. There's a pillow in the photo that has a little bit of a vulgar saying on it. Her haters were quick to shame her for having such a vulgar decoration. People were saying, why would you have that in your room? That little girl's trying to learn English, and she's going to learn all these bad words now. And Madonna did not acknowledge the decoration. She didn't really even acknowledge the photo at all, didn't respond to the comments, probably didn't even read them. But a lot of her supporters, her fans, were saying, oh, you people, you have nothing else to do. That little girl, she's so little, she probably doesn't even know what it means. Totally fine. So this was one of the little girls that she secretly adopted in February. I don't know if it was Estelle or Stella. They're twins, so it's hard to tell them apart, but she got some heat, but I think she'll be just fine.
All right, Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Now let's check in with Andrew Palczewski for the latest on what's trending on social media. Hey, Andrew.
So do you remember a couple days ago when we talked about how a study in the United Kingdom found that Instagram was the top social network to contribute to people feeling bad about themselves?
Yes.
Well, Instagram has now announced they're offering people the ability to archive their photos. Perhaps a way to maybe remove some painful past memories or try to get yourself off of Instagram for a little while.
Okay.
You can still use Instagram and still post things, but rather than just deleting them if you don't like them, you can archive them and potentially bring them back later, or you can just leave them in that archive. So they said, for instance, if you had pictures with an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend, if you had other posts that didn't do well or got maybe negative reactions, you can go ahead and archive those. So you still have them, you can still look at them, but the general public can't. So questionable whether this is going to help or hurt that idea of Instagram being harmful to folks. People are saying that it's going to make it even more of a highlight of your life. You can take out the bad photos from the past that you don't like anymore to make everything seem really picture perfect. But as I said, it could also be a nice way to remove some of the things from the past that are hurtful or things that you don't want to look at anymore. So we'll see how it plays out. They're rolling that out in the next few months. We'll see as people start using it, how they use it.
What a world we're living in.
What a time to be alive. That's what I always say.
What else? What else is going on?
Well, bit of trouble on Twitter for Kim Kardashian. She, like many celebrities, was talking about the Manchester attack and offering her condolences. And she sent out a tweet that said, "Concerts are supposed to be a place where you can let loose and have fun. It's so scary not to feel safe in this world. My heart goes out to @ArianaGrande. I love you." Which in and of itself is a very nice sentiment that she's expressed. However, along with that, she attached a photo where Ariana Grande is off in the corner of the photo. Kim Kardashian is front and center, posing with fans. Lots of people on social media, even Kim Kardashian fans, saying it was in poor taste to put up that photo.
Insensitive.
Insensitive. It's more of a publicity photo than something to try to actually remember the victims.
Ouch.
So lots of people not happy with that response. Even though the sentiment was nice in the tweet,
I'm
the
sure
photo going
well.
With it. And I'm sure she did mean well, but the photo going with it was seen as being opportunistic. So it just goes to show that even though you can write something nice, a picture really is worth 1,000 words, and those 1,000 words are outweighing the 140 characters or so that she used in that tweet.
And of course we know once something goes out on Twitter,
it's out there forever, yes. No response from Kim Kardashian that I've seen yet, but we'll see if she chooses to issue an apology or say, "I meant well, I didn't mean for it to be a publicity photo," something like that.
All right, Andrew, thanks so much. You can follow him on Twitter @APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Oscar winners Dustin Hoffman and Emma Thompson and comedians Ben Stiller and Adam Sandler are starring in a new comedy from director Noah Baumbach. It's called The Meyerowitz Stories. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the story looks at the relationships between adult men and their fathers and is competing for the top award at the Cannes Film Festival.
Adam Sandler is earning high praise for his dramatic turn as Danny Meyerowitz in The Meyerowitz Stories. Sandler plays a stay-at-home dad who never quite had the success his demanding father, Harold, a mediocre sculptor played by Dustin Hoffman, expected. Danny's marriage is ending, his daughter is leaving home for college, and he lives in the shadow of his successful half-brother Matthew, played by Ben Stiller. Matthew lives in Los Angeles and constantly refers to Danny and his sister Jean, portrayed by Elizabeth Marvel, as his half-brother and sister to emphasize their separation. But the siblings are thrown together when their father is hospitalized with a brain hemorrhage. The siblings argue over whether to sell Harold's Manhattan apartment, work together to stage a retrospective of his work at Bard College, where he was once on the faculty, and try to come to some sense of reconciliation. The film premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, where director Noah Baumbach said the comedic drama gave him a chance to explore ideas he had for years.
In various ways, in my movies, I'm interested in sort of the gap between who we think we are and or who we want to be and who we are, and how far that gap is. And obviously success and professional success and fame and, you know, and the arts is a kind of way to explore that.
Dustin Hoffman said that Baumbach has a way of bringing out the best performances from his cast, both through his comedic timing and his dramatic sensitivity.
He's quite expert. He really is the best. And we do say his dialogue word for word, whether we like it or not. And I think not since The Graduate was I required to say every single word. And it pays off because there is a music to his writing. I agree with Ben. He is a singular artist.
British Oscar winner Emma Thompson stars as Hoffman's third wife, Maureen, an alcoholic who wears tie-dyes and peace beads. Thompson said she had no real emotional frame of reference playing someone embroiled in such a dysfunctional family.
I read it and thought, I have absolutely no idea what this is going to be like. I know it's going to be fascinating, but I had no idea at all. And then I thought, oh, I've got to play an American, which is quite hard, and I've got to play an alcoholic, which isn't hard at all. So that was the thing probably that attracted me most, because I thought, well, I'll be able to relax about playing the American, because being drunk will make it so much easier.
Adam Sandler has earned many positive reviews for his portrayal of Danny, proof that he can deliver a strong dramatic performance when he is asked to. Sandler said that he wanted to give his best because of the caliber of people he was working with.
It's different for a comedian when you get an offer like this. And my first thought is I don't want to let anybody down. And I work as hard as I can to make sure I know the material and just try to be as good as I can be.
The Meyerowitz Stories is one of two Netflix entries at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Beginning next year, all films will have to have been released in French cinemas if they want to be considered for the Golden Palm. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Jerusalem, the second stop on President Donald Trump's first overseas trip, he reaffirmed the unbreakable bond of friendship between Israel and the United States, a friendship built on our shared love of freedom, our shared belief in human dignity, and our shared hope for an Israel at lasting peace. We want Israel to have peace. We have so many opportunities in front of us, said President Trump, but we must seize them together. They include advancing prosperity, defeating the evils of terrorism, and facing the threat of an Iranian regime that is threatening the region and causing so much violence and suffering. President Trump expressed hope for a more peaceful future for the region. Indeed, President Trump said the leaders he met with in Saudi Arabia all voiced common concerns about ISIS, about Iran's rising ambitions and rolling back its gains, and about the menace of extremism that has spread through too many parts of the Muslim world. America welcomes the action and support of any nation willing to do the hard but vital work of eradicating the violent ideologies that have caused so much needless bloodshed and killing in the Middle East and all over the world. I believe that a new level of partnership is possible, said President Trump, one that will bring greater safety to this region, greater security to the United States, and greater prosperity to the world. This includes a renewed effort at peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. America stands ready to assist in every way we can, said President Trump. Our deep and lasting friendship with Israel will only grow deeper and stronger as we work together in the days ahead.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.